This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
It's Helen with you from Afternoons with Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. How can we raise better boys? It is the question on the lips of many parents following some very disturbing headlines around the world. In conversation with Dr. Yaseen Aslan, he's a consultant psychiatrist and, yes, a dad too. What can we be doing at home to start difficult conversations and really inspire more respect between the sexes? Plus, Anne Jackson is a life coach, a therapist, who helps people navigate divorce and relationships too. How we raise our boys might have a long-lasting impact on their relationships. Plus, mental health in kids. Brighton College here in Dubai is putting mental health at the forefront of its curriculum when it opens in September. What is that going to look like in practice? And before it gets too hot, let's head for the hills. We were speaking to Chief Camper Vahid of Fathers and Kids Camping to get his top tips and tricks on where to go and what to pack, plus what to eat.
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And great to have you with us this afternoon. We talk about children's health, about education and about parenting. And as a parent, it is almost impossible when you have an adorable infant or a toddler to imagine that someday your child will be out in the world beyond your orbit. It's unbearable to imagine that in the wider world your child could come to harm, or even more inconceivable, could cause harm to others. So we are turning our attentions this afternoon to how can we raise boys better, is the question on so many parents' lips in light of tragic murders in the UK and subsequent outpouring of feeling from women and girls who are fed up of feeling threatened and unsafe. How should we raise our sons? And more specifically, how should we raise our sons who are there to challenge misogyny and sexism? As the mum of two young girls, it's something I find absolutely fascinating and terrifying in equal parts. Even now, I've witnessed situations in playgrounds where a boy has whacked my daughter and a parent, well-meaning but ill-informed, saying, oh, he must like her. That's not how I want my children to be in the world where violence equals good attention. It's terrifying, to be honest. It really, really is. And joining us on the line now, we've got Dr. Yaseen Aslam, consultant psychiatrist at the Psychiatry and Therapy Centre. Dr. Yaseen, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm good. I've missed you and your northern tones.
Yeah,
and
it's been a long time, actually. I actually came on for the Seychelles prize.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're a friend of the show. Sorry. And if you dare give away the answer, I'm going to put your microphone right down because lots of people getting in touch. Sorry, Doc. Now, here's a lighthearted question to kick off our chat. What's it like being a man in 2021? Because it feel like, as a woman, it's actually pretty amazing opportunities right now. And it's been a very up and down month. We know March, of course, is International Women's Month. But then in the same sentence, we're talking about women feeling unsafe on the streets of London. We are, you know, pay gap. But as a man, I feel like there's an awful lot of scrutinism, a lot of pressure and a lot of negative attention too. So as a father and as a dad, can you shed a bit of light for me?
I think it's particularly difficult given, like you said, the scrutiny and negative attention that's, that men are being subjected to at the moment. And it's forced the male segment of our population to re-examine, I believe, what it is to be a man, what is the definition of masculinity, and what are the responsibilities of men when it comes to acting as positive role models for younger boys, and also has ramifications on parenting. So I think it's forced males to re-examine what masculine ideology is, what it represents, and what our responsibilities are on a broader level in terms of influencing the way young boys are nurtured and the way they develop.
I think also it's causing a lot of men in my kind of social group to think about what it means to be an ally to women. To think, you know, we all might know someone in our social group who might be, how can I phrase it delicately, a bit handsy or a bit you know, verbally abusive, or, you know, someone that you feel like, I feel a little bit uncomfortable around. And it takes a lot for a man to say this isn't acceptable, or to call someone out on bad behavior, whether that's on social media or in real life or even in a professional space. So I think there is a lot of self-examination going on right now. And that is a positive thing, but it can feel like a lot to take on. And we are talking about raising boys today. As I said, I have daughters. The huge amount of pressure and responsibility to raise boys to be, as I said, the young men that society needs. And I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of issues are you seeing coming into clinic now when it comes to young boys and young men who are living in the world and perhaps struggling a little bit?
So I think, you know, there's the issues which are specific to the changing gender identities and the changing kind of societal perceptions of you know, what represents masculine ideology. And that is also then further compounded by the current difficulties that people are facing on a macro global level just because of the pandemic. But I think that one of the problems that we see in clinic, and it has far-reaching consequences, is the impact of, for example, the music industry and social media on influencing the narrative and, in a way, conditioning and inculcating the minds of young boys to behave and act in a certain way. And I think this is the biggest obstacle to creating healthy identities. And it's obviously a very, very difficult area to govern police and control in terms of the information that's available on social media and how that influences popular culture and influences, you know, the minds of susceptible, vulnerable young boys and young girls, for that matter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's certainly not a conversation, you know, today that we're going to be able to solve anything. But I think by having these conversations, it should be chats we're having with our kids about what's acceptable, what's not, what's banter, what's not, you know, what constitutes abuse. And we're seeing a huge amount of unfortunate news coming out of the UK right now, where a really toxic environment for young women in schools and parents, teachers being shocked, and absolutely none of those students being shocked, because they know that sometimes, you know, so-called jokes go too far, and sometimes it gets physical, and sometimes it's abuse, and sometimes it ends in absolute tragedy. And I think we need to go back to the really early childhood. And, you know, it's a stereotype, but it's a stereotype for good reason. But boys are taught to be brave, not to cry, to fight back. And we're unfortunately seeing long-term damage of that kind of teaching.
I mean, definitely, I think that there is this notion which has been popularized recently of toxic masculinity and what kind of traditional masculinity in terms of its ideology, what it represents. But certainly I believe that it does a strong emphasis on boys to suppress emotions, to not talk about feelings, and to use violence as some kind of indicator or barometer of power. This whole kind of strong guy mentality, strong guy image that's depicted in films and music, then certainly that can, I believe, create a whole host of difficulties. And in terms of how men express their feelings and relate to others, it can create a multitude of problems. So I do think that this kind of very archaic mantra of guys being strong and suppressing all of their emotions and not being allowed to experience or express at least pain in a healthy way is very damaging.
Couldn't agree more. Faison's saying the scrutiny is justified. There needs to be a lot of unlearning of subconscious sexism, misogyny in men and parents in order for us to set the right tones in our households. Masculinity has been so far defined in a significantly toxic manner. That needs to change. Men need to change. If there's one thing that boy needs to learn at an early age, it's consent. Tim saying Gloria Steinem had it right when she said many of us have started raising our daughters more like our sons. Few of us have had the courage to raise our sons more like our daughters. Thanks for that, Tim. Dr. Yassine, I wanted to ask you this. Ginny saying, on bullying, I'm getting conflicting advice on how my boy should handle it. I tell them to tell a teacher when someone harms them or says something. My husband, who's from a different culture, says always fight back no matter what. Any advice, which one will strengthen their character?
I think that there's a fine line between making children strong and being able to defend themselves and also acting correctly in a situation like that. My advice to, in a situation where, anyone's son is being bullied in school is always to, report it to the teacher. The schools always have protocols and policies to deal with these matters. They can look into it. They can investigate it. I would never encourage children to react of their own volition and not seek appropriate professional help and alert it to the teachers, because it can always then run in. You can get into all kinds of problems and difficulties. Mm-hmm. So I think that, discuss it with the parents, report it to the parents, report it to the school, raise it as an issue, and allow the school to follow their protocols in order to support the children and hopefully stamp it out and deal with it appropriately. I think reacting to bullying and for children to take matters into their own hands, which can sometimes happen indirectly or inadvertently when you encourage children to stand up for themselves, can lead to a whole host of problems and difficulties. So I think encouraging children to report it to the teacher, to talk to the parents about it, report it to an adult, is always a more preferable step.
And I wanted to ask this question from Elle, saying, I overheard my son and his friends talking about girls and rating their appearances. I know it's something teenagers do, but I was so shocked hearing it from my son's mouth. Any advice on how to speak to him about it? My husband shrugged it off, said it's a phase, and told me to stop trying to fix what's not broken. But maybe he needs fixing too. This is where the so-called banter starts to feel, gross, to be honest. How do you begin to address this and try and stem the objectification of young women?
Well, I think that's the key, really. I think normal kind of banter between teenagers talking about women and girls talking about boys can be part of normal teenage development. But there is clearly a boundary and a moral line. And I guess it's determining where that lies. And I think, obviously, if there is any evidence of kind of certain attitudes becoming pervasive, mm-hmm. or entrenched, centred upon the objectification of women, or, for example, the degradation of women, or if there's attitudes which suggest a lack of respect for women, then obviously these are very unhealthy attitudes which need to be challenged from a very early stage. And I guess it's all about having strong and open lines of communication with your children so that you're able to talk about these subjects. And if there are any kind of unhealthy attitudes centered around objectification or deprecation, then we can always unearth these and start to deal with and challenge these, and also find out what the roots of these ideas are. Is it, going back to what I said earlier, is it something they're watching? Is it something related to social media?
Is it conversations music? That they're, that they might have overheard, other generations having? I mean, I remember early on when I started dating my husband, he was saying, and it's UK boarding schools that are massively in the press right now out of the UK talking about, a problematic culture, shall we say. And my husband said he remembers on the first day of his school, which was a boarding school, girls stepping off the bus and boys sitting on the grass with the numbers from the cricket signs, holding up numbers, marking them out of 10, mm-hmm. and him laughing. And I'm like, these are young women. We have daughters now. I mean, I really feel like having encouraging friendships with the opposite sex can really go a long way to actually seeing them as people, not just as, Elle saying here, rating their appearances. Message here, anonymous message saying, I think it's not healthy to only put the onus on men to change. Surely there is a debate about the role of women in how men behave. What unhealthy behaviours that men exhibit are regarded by women as a result encouraging this behaviour? Do expand on that. I'd be interested to hear some examples of what you're talking about. What about culture? What role does culture play when it comes to where traditional roles might end up crossing into degrading behaviour?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because there are different kind of cultural perceptions in terms of what is a male identity and what's a female identity and the different gender roles and how they manifest. But I think that mutual respect for both sexes and respect for men and women is a pervasive kind of human kind of universal truth, isn't it? Which traverses all cultures. I don't think that that you can use the argument that, you know, certain types of objectification beliefs or attitudes are supported within a cultural context. So, you know, I think, you know, the basic premise of whichever culture you kind of are from is that there should be mutual respect, reciprocity, tolerance between men and women. And I think that's fundamental to any society. Yes, they may. I think there's been a global shift in cultural attitudes over the past 50 years of seismic proportions. I mean, I was looking at one of the advertisements from the UK in the 1950s. I think it was around gravy, and in this advertisement, the man was coming home, and the woman was, you know, working hard to prepare the house and keep all the children clean and smart, while the dad was welcomed home with open arms. And that kind of old homemaker traditional stereotype has completely changed.
I don't know. UK government came under a huge amount of scrutiny over the last couple of months. They did some campaigns around lockdown and showed three little cartoons, and it was a woman with the kids, a woman vacuuming up, and a man watching on the TV. You know, it is quite extraordinary some things still get signed off. And I agree, 50 years is not a huge amount of time given you know, how long we've been on the earth, but my goodness, there's still an awful lot of work to do. I wanted to ask you, for anyone who has teenage sons, should they be talking about some of the things that they're seeing in the press right now and raising this, and how? Because trying to start conversations with teenagers of either sex is a challenge at times.
I think it's a very important subject, and I think that it's important for parents to have continued dialogue with their children about topical issues, especially an issue like this. And it's always good to know what their opinions and beliefs are, and really to understand a bit more about, you know, what's happening in their kind of circles. I think as parents, we have to try to make more of an effort to be more connected emotionally and psychologically with our children, to be more in tune. Because I think that since the advent of social media and technology, the disconnect between our generation and the next generation is growing. And I think that unless we maintain that healthy dialogue and that communication and connection, we're going to find that we're on completely different playing fields.
So I think
absolutely. So I think, given the fact that these issues are very present at the moment in the media, that provides a very easy platform to raise these kinds of discussions with our children.
Thank you, Dr. Seen. Really appreciate your time this afternoon. And if you want to talk further with Dr. Seen, you can find him at the Psychiatry and Therapy Centre. We are
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing this afternoon what to teach our sons, how to raise young men in 2021. And someone who's been speaking to a lot of families and seeing the effects of how we've raised our boys is Anne Jackson, a therapist and life coach, an expert on relationships, parenting and self-improvement. Loving all of your messages so far. Troy saying, about young men, raise them to be a gentleman, mentor them about situations at school, never hit or be mean to a woman, listen and be kind, be tough but fair, learn the difference between violence and toughness, listen to respectful music, understand your place in the world and what he expects you to be. Troy's got three daughters and a son. Troy, thank you for that. Anne Jackson, how are you this afternoon?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure. I have to say, I feel quite relieved having two daughters. I feel like it's a massive responsibility to be raising boys right now. An awful lot of scrutiny around. And as we said, we don't want to be demonising young men. And I feel like it's very wrong to put all of the entire gender in a you know, in the naughty corner off the back of some very, very bad behaviour of a few. But I feel like there's a lot of responsibility on young men to be calling out bad behaviour that they're seeing amongst their peers. And I would say that that's from school age all the way up to adulthood, you know. And I wanted to put a question to you this afternoon. And, you know, you're approached often by married couples at different stages of their relationship. You know, some come to you on the verge of divorce. But you believe a lot of their problems are rooted in the behaviour that they were programmed to have as children. Can you tell us more?
Well, a lot of people come with a problem in their marriage, and I will start speaking to them either individually or together, and I'll realise that it's a problem in them processing either their own emotions that they've never actually looked at, or processing just emotions in general, their partner's emotions. They're just not there and they can't do it. And they were told when they were little, a lot of boys were told when they were little, you know, to suppress their emotions, not to look at it. And when I first moved to this area 21 years ago, a very long time ago, I used to hear people say, I don't like drama. Men especially, they used to say, I don't like drama. You know, I don't like drama. And I actually thought they meant drama, as in drama incidents. But when you sort of dug down, they meant, I don't like emotions. I don't want my wife to talk about emotions. I don't want to talk about emotions. Let's ignore the emotions. And they were taught from little to ignore emotions, like boys have to be boys with no emotions. So it makes two emotionally balanced, happy people to make an emotionally balanced, happy marriage. When you have two unemotionally balanced, unhappy people, you're not going to get a happy marriage. So it's not about the marriage, it's about them first. Mm-hmm. But quite often I'll work with them as individuals before I bring them back together to work on the marriage.
So to any parents listening who do have young boys or teenage boys, you know, what are the things that we can teach our sons that you believe can help them in future relationships, friendships as well as romantic relationships?
So what was just said a minute ago, what you said about, you know, boys need to know their place in the world, the pendulum has sort of gone from one extreme to the other, that boys don't know their place in the world. When I talk to my son, who's 18, and his friends, and I talk to my daughter, who's 15, and her friends, boys and girls are finding it hard to figure out the place in the world. And the social media, as Dr. Yassine said, is having such a huge influence, so that us as parents will say, oh, we were teenagers once. Well, we weren't. We were never teenagers like they are. Mm-hmm. We have never gone through their reality. So us learning their reality, us as grown-ups learning their reality and actually getting into that, and then talking to them about their reality in their time and not trying to impose our reality, it would be a great thing. And even talking about, you know, not having this gender disparity, but it's not about raising good boys and good girls. It's about raising good human beings with good values and good moral standing, whatever moral standing in their culture that is.
I agree.
But it's about raising good human beings. And I was recently talking to a Danish lady, and she said to me, obviously it's just one, it's not the whole of Denmark I interviewed, but she said there is no woman empowerment in Denmark because there is no disparity. We are considered equals, men and women. And I was like, wow, what an amazing place to be. Like, a totally amazing place to be. We're all different as individuals. We're not all equal as individuals. You shouldn't treat all your children equally because they have different personalities. But it doesn't mean that we are different as genders. We're just different as individuals.
We've been sent a link to an article on Facebook, headline being, A Victorian School, this is coming out of Australia, has admitted it missed the mark after asking all male students to stand up in an assembly and apologise for their gender in the wake of the Justice for Women movement. That is going too far. Definitely not the message we want our boys to get. And as you say, it's about being good people, good society. You know, we talk about we want the world to be a better place for our children. I think we all just want our children to be better for the world. You know, we want that to be about kindness and empathy and respect.
I always teach the teenager clients I see, and also the teenagers that I have myself, is like, to me, there's one rule, which is you should not hurt somebody physically, emotionally, or mentally. And you shouldn't hurt yourself physically, emotionally, or mentally. If you're doing that, if you're not hurting someone else, then everything else is kind of okay to go and discover. So if you want to dye your hair purple within the cultural bounds of every culture that is different, but it's not hurting anyone. But as long as you're not hurting someone, as soon as you're hurting someone emotionally, physically, or mentally, then you know you're going down the wrong path, be you a male or a female.
I wanted to ask you about the parenting of boys and how often men and women can come to the relationship, as you alluded to earlier, with kind of very different perspectives on expressing emotion, aspirations, you know, even hobbies and preferences and friendships. How can parents get on the same team so we're not getting conflicting messages for our children and, you know, that child feeling safe to express themselves?
I think parents need a lot of education. In fact, I've had parents say to me, can you do some seminars on this? Can you do some education on this? Parents need a lot of education on where their teenagers are at, or even from 11. So from sort of the age of year six onwards, you'll find that in year six, a lot of boys will start being angry for no reason. A lot of girls will start crying for no reason, just the way they are genetically. And it's to do with their hormones going everywhere. But a lot of parents who have boys in year six, for example, will come to me going, my son is this, that, and the other, like, it's just a natural phase they're going through. It doesn't mean we have to encourage them to be angry or let them be angry, but we also have to understand what our children are going through. They are not going through what we went through. So the parents need a lot of educating on how to raise their children and raise their boys. And as I said, the pendulum has struck so far the other way that children are kind of free-falling with no parachute. They don't know where they're going either. There's a lot of parenting, parents and children, just the old values, the old rules, the old norms are kind of out the window, and people are going, well, what are the new ones and where do we go?
I wanted to put a question to you from AH, who's been on the text line saying, my 16-year-old boy has been lacking empathy and interest in his family. He seems more drawn to his friends and is spending less and less time with us as a family. Should I worry? I hate the word normal, but I wondered if you're able to offer some insights on what kind of typical behaviour in a 16-year-old boy.
So teenagers from about the age of 14, they start having sort of their emotions connecting more. They start feeling their emotions more, and they need to be around their peers more. This is completely normal. But their peers mean more to them than their family for a certain age, but they will come back. As long as you don't put pressure on them that you have to do this with us out of duty, which then makes them run away from you. If you sort of say, you know, you can come and join in with us, or you can go see your friends, and as long as you trust their friends as well, that they're not in with the wrong crowd, as it were, but they will come back. They need their peer time because they're like crystallizing into a butterfly, and they need to go away and kind of cocoon and find their wings a bit and away from their parents to find their own steps. So I'm never scared that teenagers are going away because they all come back. They literally come back. Just let them find their own space.
Thank you, and really appreciate your time this afternoon. If people do need any coaching or therapy around relationships, divorce, mediation and parenting, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
They can go on my website, which is onelifecoachingme.com, or they can call me on 050-518-6821.
You're a star. Thank you so, so much, and really appreciate your time.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us. We discuss education as ever on Sunday afternoons, and we'd love to hear from you. What has your school put in place to look after the mental wellness of your child? It's not just about academics or indeed getting on this podium on Sports Day. When our children feel safe and secure and happy, it's proven that's when they learn best, especially given the challenges of the last 12 months. To discuss what Brighton College Dubai Sixth Form will be doing when it launches later this year, delighted to be joined by the founding head, Joe Hall, speaking to us from South Korea before he returns to Dubai in a couple of months. Joe, thank you so much for your... Sorry, did I say Joe? Should I say Mr. Hall? What feels more normal for you?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, yeah. Joe.
Great. Okay, so, Joe, I feel like... I mean, I've said this before. You couldn't pay me to be 16 again. I loved some of it. But it's a very, very, very challenging time. There's all manner of hormones that I think we merrily forget about when we become parents ourselves. There's academic rigours and, unfortunately now, going out into a job market that might be completely different to what it looked like a year ago. There could be areas of passion or academic excellence where the jobs might not be there. To be intrigued as to why you've taken the decision to introduce a curriculum with mental health and well-being when you do launch come September. Are you able to explain a little bit about what it's going to look like in practice before we start talking about the whys?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it's sort of trying to bring together things that we've been doing in the Brighton College schools in bits and you know, obsessions and odd days. But what we really want to do is embed into our curriculum, something that is practiced and talked about on a daily and a weekly basis. What we want to introduce, or what we'll be introducing, is a program that's based around something called the PERMA model. And PERMA stands for the five kind of key characteristics of well-being and happiness. It comes on the back of a lot of research that's been going on for the last 15, 20 years. And the PERMA acronym is standing for positive emotions, engagement, positive relationships, meaning, and accomplishments. And what that really means is trying to approach the well-being of young people, not from the kind of traditional view on illness or the pathology, but actually looking at what's good and what's positive in life. So what we'll be doing on a sort of weekly basis is getting them to focus on what the values are that matter to them and how they can actually build the kind of resilience and the habitual thinking, and that will actually build all of those five attributes. So it's going to be very much personalized and individual. It's not sitting in a classroom listening to someone telling them how to be happy. It's about finding their own pathway through those emotions.
But can I ask, will it be interwoven throughout the curriculum, or is it going to be a designated lesson as such?
Well, it's really everything we do. So, I mean, there's always been a huge focus on these kind of things in the Brighton College schools. But there will be individual sessions which really help them to reflect and focus on their own progress and their own journey. But all of those kind of attributes and those kind of foci will be in everything that we do. And a lot of it is stuff that happens anyway. Obviously, things like building positive relationships is a huge part of the work of any school. But sometimes it's just, you just need a little bit of extra time with the students to get them to reflect on it themselves and to talk about it a bit more.
And this is going to be a big part of your role then, having almost that kind of pastoral care, spending time with the pupils and supporting them beyond the curriculum.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think now we've, most schools that offer A-levels like Brighton College have realised that actually most of the work to be done now beyond kind of the academic achievement is around well-being, around nutrition, around health. And certainly in the last 12 months, we've seen a lot of parents actually asking about those things more when they're coming to look around schools than they have about the sort of traditional, exam results. So I see that as an absolutely fundamental part of being head of sixth form and being there for, as you said, these people have got such a difficult journey in many ways through that age group.
And preparing them for that post-COVID world, the real world. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about the offering is, talking about those transferable skills like public speaking, presentation skills, interview techniques, which is so key. I'm going to be talking about that for grown-ups on tomorrow's show. But you also talked about information and media literacy. Why do you feel like that is such a key part of mental health for children of a sixth form age?
Well, I mean, the students that we work with, obviously, they know what's going on in the world. They're very much aware of all of the difficulties they're facing as a civilization at the minute. It's not just COVID. It's the inequality, the climate change, all of the news that they see can seem very negative and very quite scary sometimes. And I think it's really important that we make sure that they're able to access and process what they're reading and what they're listening to, and also that they can be discerning and critical thinkers in a time where we're being thrown so much information, so much fake news, things coming from all different angles. And I think a lot of the students that I talk to do feel sometimes completely overwhelmed, and that can be frightening. And that's where the mental health issues come in.
What about when there might be a case, or several cases, or perhaps many cases, where you feel like expert help is required, whether that is, support from a psychologist or talk therapy? Do you have the resources to bring in, trained experts as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist in any way, or a counsellor, and nor are most staff, which is why we obviously have our counselling department and trained counsellor. And then beyond that, in the wider Dubai community, there will be times when we need outside input and when students need to see people. So this is what we're building into the curriculum in no way is a substitution for proper professional counselling and external support. But what we think is important is that every student, not just those that are going through mental health crises or problems, every student has the opportunity to really to build that resilience and that vitality and that life satisfaction as much as we can in every day in school.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday and I've been speaking to Mr. Hall, Joe, as he let me call him, head of sick form at Brighton College in Dubai. It's opening in September and mental health will be very much front and centre of the curriculum. Last week in the UK, more than 5,800 anonymous testimonials cataloguing acts of sexual harassment, abuse and assault in schools have been posted on a website called Everyone's Invited. And sadly, they are still coming in. So I asked Joe about the culture of abuse in schools, an indication of how society behaves.
I don't think it's an issue just in the UK at all. It's everywhere. And I think those are exactly the kind of conversations and things that, particularly with the age group that I work with, 19, where it's really important to discuss this in a proper way with the students. And that involves, preparing a programme that looks at some of these issues. It's something that is increasingly important, and I think the emphasis is on us increasingly to address these issues. Actually, in the UAE, and certainly having worked for 5 years in the UAE, I think actually in many ways we're quite lucky to be away from some of the kind of worst examples of that. But I don't think that's an excuse to ignore it either, and I think that it's something that as professionals and as teachers we need to take by the horns and discuss properly.
It's going to be really interesting to see how other schools are responding. I mean, I know when my kids went back to school, and my children are much, much younger than sick form. One started FS1 in September and the other one's in year one. But even at that age, their school had a huge emphasis on wellness. Lots of, talking about feelings, naming feelings, meditations. Mm. And, I could see, my parents, that generation, kind of going, oh, okay, that's not really what we were expecting. But that, those softer skills, that emotional intelligence has become so, so important. And, as I said earlier, it's when our children feel safe that they are able to, respond to educators and respond to the curriculum. And I'd love to hear from people about what's being done in their schools around that mental health and opening the conversation up. Do you feel like teachers perhaps could be a bit more vulnerable talking about their own struggles, or is that somewhat crossing a line?
No, not at all. I think, we've all been, in the last 12 months, we've all been through the same experience together. And I think teachers and students in many ways have had very similar experiences in terms of, the online learning and the isolation and the frustrations and the lack of human-to-human interaction. And I think actually that's probably one of the best places to start. I think our pupils and our students really do listen and really do feel a sense of empathy when teachers do open up. Reflecting back on the last 12 months, I think we've learned an awful lot about the limits of technology, and at the beginning of 2020, perhaps there was a bit of enthusiasm for moving more and more online, and I think we've realised just how important schools are and how important it is to actually have the children in school. There's absolutely no substitution for those, meaningful sessions on wellbeing that schools are running all over the place now, so absolutely.
I hope teachers are getting the help that they need as well.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
If you follow me on Instagram, you might have realised that I have definitely caught the camping bug. Luckily, I've married a man who not only is happy to buy an extra shed for all the equipment, but might be even more obsessed than me. We are going camping before it gets too hot with Fahid. He's the chief camper at Father and Kids Camping. If you've got any questions for Fahid, get in touch. Equally, if you've got any suggestions, camping spots, the bits of kit that you go camping with your kids with, any solutions to the toilet situation, get in touch now on 4001 or use, of course, that ARN Play app. Fahid, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am well, thank you. We didn't go camping this weekend, which was, after doing two weekends in a row, it was nice to spend the night, under a roof rather than under canvas, so to speak. And we've done a bit of desert camping, we've done Hatta, we've done beach. So can you tell us about some of your top camping spots in the UAE when you go off with father and kids camping? Where are some of your faves?
Well, we've been spoiled in that we've been doing camping for about 10 years now.
Wow.
We've seen the mountains, we've seen the dunes, the seas, and really we are spoiled for our options here. And although there have been some restrictions imposed recently due to COVID in terms of where you can camp, there's still plenty of options. I would say that if you're more of a desert dunes person, I would recommend Margam Desert area, which is just past the Sevens Stadium on your left side. If you take the Margam exit from the Alain Road, you'll be able to find some beautiful dunes.
This is really embarrassing. I always have problems differentiating between the Alain Road and the Hatta Road. So what I have to do is, I know on the Hatta Road is Dubai Safari, so I imagine animals wearing hats. This is what we're working with this afternoon. So the Alain Road, and just can you spell out the name of the exit just for people to take any notes?
Sure. Margam is Margam, and it's practically the first exit after the Sevens Stadium, which is also on the Alain Road. So you pass the Sevens where you will go see the rugby, and you'll see Margam. You take the exit, you take the left, and as you head into the road eventually becomes a dirt road, and the dirt road eventually becomes dunes. Just keep going. You follow the trails, and within a 20-minute drive, you'll be able to enjoy beautiful sceneries, very quiet, off the road. You won't see much traffic. You won't see any much planes in the air, and it'll be just perfect serenity.
Oh, you're making me want to go camping again. My only issue is, and I am fully aware that I might be living in the wrong part of the world for someone who doesn't really love sand, which is why we've gravitated towards some mountain spots. Now, we are lucky enough to have, you know, Shauka quite close, Hatta quite close. Anywhere a bit further afield, you know, going even across to Rak that you guys have enjoyed with father and kids?
Yes. I mean, Ras Al Khaimah is absolutely amazing. You have Al Ain, which is amazing. You have Oman, which is absolutely stunning, particularly this time of the year. Of course, because of COVID and because of the limitations in terms of where you can go, for most, I think you would still get lots of options if you just had to stay within the Emirate of Dubai and head for Hatta. There is still some good diversity of options around Wadi Hub. And just 2 weeks ago, the group and myself, we went there and we just had a phenomenal time pairing camping with hiking, which you have done. And it's a really fantastic formula.
The gear, I think a lot of people go, I love the idea of it, but am I going to have to drop, you know, 5,000 dirhams on a super duper tent and, you know, sleeping bags that will take me down to minus 10 degrees and a stove and. In terms of my tips, the best thing we've bought is a fire pit that I think was 70 dirhams from a supermarket, like a grocery store on Beach Road. And it has served us so, so well. What do you think are some of the essential bits of kit for a first time camper?
Yeah, fire pit is absolutely amazing because it also prevents you from having to do the fire directly in the dune or in the mountain. And so from a conservation point of view, it's fantastic. So well done to you. I think the other few items that are very important right now, particularly, is a shade. You want to go and buy a shade for yourself because it gives you, you know, a nice covered area to protect yourself against the sun and to enjoy the weather more and further into the summer. You also want to perhaps get a solid tent. And this doesn't have to cost you very much. You could get it at Adventure HQ or at Carrefour, but get yourself a similar tent that you have, like the Coleman pop-up tent.
Well, what I would say about
that,
just a quick shout out for the pop-up tent. Just, I think anything that avoids arguments, anything that's going to avoid having like divorce in the dunes where you're bickering about how to do something. And this one, yeah, it just pops up. It takes literally minutes. Sorry,
yes.
That was absolutely no sponsored in any shape or form, unfortunately.
Yeah, and honestly, like having done it for 10 years, I fully agree. Like the last thing you want to be doing when you get to the site and you're tired and it's hot is start freaking like poking sticks into mm-hmm. into each other. The really simplifying your, and the Frisbee tents are amazing to set up, but then refilling it into the bag, not so easy. That's why the pop-up tent is really a beautiful in-between solution. And as you said, it's a no-hassle. You could do it, putting it up and hold a drink in your hand at the same time. And trust me, I've done this.
Goals. I spoke to some friends at the weekend. They've got a tent that's got blackout material. It's like, that sounds amazing. So that's my next. Is it weird to have a Christmas list already? I know a really kind of common question or concern is what car to have, because, you know, not everyone has a 4x4 in Dubai. Are there any camping spots that you could get to in a sedan? You mentioned Mogham now. You know, could you go park up on the dirt track and then walk over a dune to find a camping spot? Or are there anywhere that you could get to without a 4x4?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, if you, for example, if you drive past Al Khodra, past the bicycle track, and past the kind of the lake area, you'll see the Mohammed bin Rashid Solar Park. Mm-hmm. There, the roads are still manageable. They're like dirt roads, and you could drive like a Toyota Camry equivalent of a taxi there to some extent. And even before it gets too crazy, you could put up a tent and have a nice, quiet, relaxing experience. But the more important, I think, is to really drive in convoy. Mm-hmm. You never want to drive alone, because if anything happens, you want to make sure that you have backup. And even if you do have a 4x4, it's very important to make sure that your spare tire is properly inflated, and that you know where you can keep the repair kit, because sometimes you have it, you've never used it before. You don't want to be, you know, changing your tire for the first time in the dune.
Sweating and, again, divorce in the dunes. Fahid, thank you so, so much.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
We are going camping with Fahid, who runs Father and Kids Camping. They're a closed group and they organise camping trips. A brilliant website with loads of resources on there too. We've been chatting about what to expect when camping. You've got a tent, you're in your camping gear, 4x4 is ready for the adventure. But there's a few things that Fahid mentions that we should keep in mind. First of all, a common concern, the toilet situation.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Luckily, there's been innovation in the space where you now have little miniature pop-ups that look like a porta cabin that serve as essentially a toilet, which you could put behind your tent as kind of essentially your mobile bathroom. And so there are the options of those. There's also glamping options where you could actually work with an organizer that specializes in this, and one of them would be Sand Sherpa, which provides you with all the facilities that you would need in order to kind of have all the comfort you would expect from a camp, so that they would provide you with the equipment, the cooking area, the eating area, so that you have perfect comfort you would need without having to worry about having to bring all the gear and to set everything up.
Good. I think that's a bit of a softer landing for lots of people who might be kind of venturing into the wilderness for the first time. Food is the other thing I wanted to ask you, because cooking by head torch, especially cooking something like chicken, can end in needing that toilet tent perhaps more than you wanted to. What are some of your best ways of feeding groups when you're out and about, whether that's in the dunes or in the mountains? What do you take to cook on or over? And even some favorite dishes would be great.
Preparing the meal is one of the highlights of any camping trip, because it typically ends up being a community event, and so it's really a highlight. And what I would do is recommend that you first start with the freshest ingredients. And for your meat, you want to get the best meat. We recommend Prime Gourmet, which provides fantastic chicken and even better steaks that you could bring and barbecue it to perfection and really have a fantastic meal. We've in the past also done, we've gone fishing and we've had like barracuda or hamur. And so the ingredients are the first most important thing, but you can also get creative. For example, this past weekend, we went camping, and for the lunch for the kids, rather than just giving them hot dogs or burgers, what we decided to do is have a Mexican theme, and we cooked, we took
burritos with chicken burritos and beef burritos, and we fill them with vegetables and a juicy sauce. And because at that point all the kids are running around, they're really getting hungry, they will eat it up and soak it all up so that they're eating
true.
Well
so
and
true.
You're getting them to try a new dish.
The never underestimate the power of fresh air to bring out a kid's appetite. They will demolish food. And interesting about kind of doing something a bit different as well. Last time we went, we cooked ahead of time and did like a lamb tagine that just needed heating up and some crusty bread. And then that was a dead simple one kind of ahead of time. If you are going in a group, I think it can make sense for, you know, one family to take care of lunch, the next family to do dinner, the next one to do breakfast as well. I mean, I know you go in really in really big groups.
In fact, that's exactly what we do, Helen. What we do is meal teams. The meal team is headed by team leader. That team leader then helps orchestrate the menu. The meal team then delivers the menu to the full camp, and then their job is done. So that you have one job to do, one meal to prepare, and then the rest of the camping trip, you're enjoying different creative dishes prepared by different groups. So your idea of doing like meal teams, we've done it, it's proven, it's highly recommended.
You're making me hungry. You're making me seriously hungry. And I think that preparation is absolutely key, because otherwise you end up going back with a cooler box full of food that you haven't eaten and might not be safe to eat once you get back. So,
and that's often, and that's another excellent point. We tend to, over pack in terms of food as people. And so, because especially when you're in meal teams, it's very important to kind of like be conservative with the amount of food that you bring, because more often than not, the food will be wasted. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, you'll have to go back with food in your cooler. So highly recommend that people bring less food than they think they need and really focus on the quality. Because this way, I mean, we've done this for 10, 11 years. Never have we gone hungry on any of our trips.
But do take more water than you think you're going to need. 100%.
Yes, and that's another very, very important point. One of the things that we have noticed on our trips is as camping becomes more popular and more people go camping, there is a tendency to kind of, leave trash behind. Mm-hmm. And the biggest culprit here that we see is plastic bottles. And it's really heartbreaking when you see, debris in areas where you have camels breeding and you have desert foxes roaming. And one of the policies that we have at Fathers and Kids Camping is we have banned single-use plastic. And I know that San Sharpa also banned it. And so what we've done instead, and I'm sure you probably did the same, is we bring these 5-gallon jugs mm-hmm. with the pump, and we encourage all of our members to bring their own reusable bottles and to fill up their bottles instead of bringing single-use plastic. This cuts down on your waste, cuts down on the trash you have to bring back, and reduces the risk of pollution.
We spoke recently to Laura of Hike UAE, and she also stressed the importance of leaving no trace. And I said then, we went camping at Ras Al Khaimah last week, and beautiful spot on Saraya Island, but the trash just, it ruined it for me. I just left feeling really deflated and a bit like, ugh, because of just total lack of respect. And something this is really embarrassing to admit, the big hit in our family recently is from Amazon. I bought the kids 30 dirham litter pickers. And that's become our kind of morning after camping experience. We have breakfast and then we go and pick up everyone else's trash. And I know how that sounds, how smug and Pinterest mum it sounds. But the kids absolutely love it. We shouldn't have to do it in the first place, though.
But what you've done is a great example for everyone else. And I recommend you, in fact, post it on your Instagram to remind people that, A, it's an issue that should be prevented and also tackled through by doing these collections. And we always have a cleanup session before we decamp in the mornings, and all the kids pair up in twos and they kind of roam and they clean up the area around the periphery so that we literally leave our campsites cleaner than how we found them.
I know we'll be getting questions on how to join Father and Kids Camping, and it's not necessarily an open group. If people wanted to get in contact with you, is it the best? Is the website the best way of getting in touch?
Definitely, yes. Fathersandkidscamping.com is where you have a perfect platform for getting all the information that you would need, where to go, what to bring, what to pack. As you mentioned, we will do our best to accommodate, but it's a closed group. But where we can, we will definitely help so that we introduce more people to the wonderful outdoors that the UAE has to offer.
I have to say, I absolutely love it. What about some mum's trips soon?
We always have mum's trips every year. And I should say that most of our members also do mum's trips on alternative weekends. It's not just like just go camping with the dads and the kids. It's just a different dynamics.
And so great for the kids. There's nothing like a nice post-camping driving back nap to make you feel like you've done a good job as a parent, really tiring them out. So thank you so much for your insights this afternoon. It is fatherandkids.com. And have you got any camping trips planned before it gets a little bit too hot out there?
Yes, we just did one last weekend, and we're probably going to plan one during the Easter holiday. I highly recommend people to get out there between now and Ramadan.
So get out there before it gets too hot. That was Vahid Fatouhi of Father and Kids Camping, the chief camper of the group.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. It helps boost us in the ratings, help other people find us, and of course you get it direct to your phone as well. You can hear us live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.